Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
This episode is brought to you by PwC. When unprecedented times are all the time, it's time to start walking the talk. Leaders like you turn to PwC to see and stay ahead. Upskill your workforce, use intelligent automation, and transform big ideas into breakthrough reinvention. Explore the human-led, tech-powered solutions that help you reinvent. It's all part of the new equation. Learn more at pwc.com.
Hello and welcome to the Analyst Inside Cricket, our regular reflection on all the goings-on in the cricket world, particularly the international world at the moment, with three test matches underway and finished last weekend, and all of them, interestingly, won by the home team by an innings. Of course, England losing heavily to New Zealand, Australia beating Pakistan, and Bangladesh losing the second test in a row to India, all by an innings. So we'll sort of ask some questions about what's to be done about that, particularly with England. Also, later in the programme, another little story. This concerns the Ashes Urn, which is making its own trip to Australia, a rare visit away from its cabinet in the MCC Museum. So we're going to have a look at the whole history of the Ashes Urn, how many times it's been away, and what's happening to it this time. Maximum security as it makes a little visit of its own with its own business class seat to Australia for a special exhibition. Simon, you've been in Mount Maunganui. Actually, the weather has looked absolutely incredible. That's the one sort of high point for you, I suppose, is 5 days of interesting cricket in just glorious conditions.
It's been absolutely fantastic, the weather. Debut test match at the Bay Oval. They could have not had better weather for it. 5 days of unbroken sunshine. An interesting game of cricket. It wasn't totally captivating the whole time. The pitch was very flat, which actually, when you think about it, it does no credit to England whatsoever. The fact that really on this pitch, they should have not lost this game. They should have been good enough to score enough runs to challenge this New Zealand side. So much went wrong for England this week, but huge tribute to the ground staff and those who organised the first ever test match at Mount Maunganui. You know, it'd be great to come back here and teams will enjoy playing at the Bay Oval. It was a fantastic experience, really well done. The crowds were decent as well. And, you know, let's hope they get another test match fairly soon. Let's hope the pitch is a bit more responsive to the bowlers, but New Zealand was still good enough to win the game.
It adds to England's sort of portfolio of poor performances on flat pitches, doesn't it? They don't seem to have the gumption and the dedication to bat a long time on a flat pitch, because there was really nothing in that wicket at all. Or, even more worryingly in a way, find ways of getting wickets on flat pitches. You just have to look at how dedicatedly the sort of lower order of the New Zealanders, particularly BJ Watling, played, just not ever giving it away, grinding out runs in a boring but very effective way. And then somebody like Neil Wagner, who, you know, hasn't got necessarily the sort of glamorous skills of some bowlers around the world, but he's got that. He's got an incredible heart. He's got that total commitment. He doesn't care what the pitch is like. He will make something happen. And, well, 5 for on that pitch was outstanding.
And what was even more outstanding about Wagner, I agree, is, you know, he's a really wholehearted competitor. He hurls down his bouncers, he bowls lots of bouncers, whacks the ball into the pitch. He stands in the middle of the pitch, glaring at the batsman, has a word as well. What makes it even more remarkable in a way, even more noteworthy and praiseworthy, was that effectively New Zealand were down to three bowlers today. Trent Bolt was off the field with a side problem. Colin de Grandhomme's got an injury as well, so he didn't bowl after about 12:15 after getting rid of Joe Root to what was a very poor shot, even by the captain's admission. He said that himself. You know, he played two poor shots in the match. So they were back, basically down to three bowlers. And Santner bowled from one end most of the day. And at the other end, Southee, who's got one of the slowest walk backs in international cricket, and looked very tired by the end of it. And Neil Wagner just kept on running in. He's like a sort of bouncing ball. He just can't keep him down. Superb effort. England helped him, of course. The Ollie Pope shot, oh, I can still see it now, a wide full toss, which was a slower ball, admittedly, which deceived him, pushed to cover where Santner took an excellent catch, going away to his right. Josh Butler leaving the first ball with the second new ball, and it swung back in. And then Joe Denley actually got a snorter, the one that really took off and just flicked the underside of his glove. He played really well, Joe Denley, actually. He was very unlucky. But you know, Wagner making things happen. And you're right, England just were not able to do that. You know, there were times when England were bowling, especially when they came out on the fourth morning, and they were talking positively about, you know, restricting New Zealand's lead and getting among them. But I just couldn't actually see how they were going to get a wicket. I could not see where it was coming from. And lo and behold, it didn't happen. I mean, it was actually impossible. Who was going to get the wicket? There was nothing happening whatsoever. It was a very flat pitch. I think the point being, really, is that England failed to get a huge score in their first innings, a really significant score in their first innings. They talked about batting long, and they weren't able to do it. They frittered their wickets away. They weren't ruthless enough. They got into a decent position on that first day. And, you know, they should have made 450, 500. They should have scored enough runs in that first innings to at least draw the game, really. So, really bitterly disappointing from England. They are really, really struggling away from home. They don't have the firepower to win on flat pitches overseas, and they lack the technical ability to bat long overseas.
Yeah, and it looks like they've almost been spoilt by the Duke ball, certainly the bowlers, because in England, in English conditions, there's always something happening with that Duke's ball because it's got great shine and a great seam. So you never lose heart as a bowler, really, because something's always going to happen. But with a Kookaburra on these flat pitches, you need more than just an expectation, don't you? You need kind of this total commitment. And it's like climbing a mountain almost. You've got to follow it all the way through. And there's no point in sort of semi-giving up halfway through and throwing your hands up and saying, well, what can I do on here? And I suppose if you look at, I think the blueprint for winning a test match on, you know, a flat pitch with a Kookaburra ball was shown by Australia in that first test at the Gabba against Pakistan, where, you know, those bowlers, Cummins, Stark and Hazelwood, yeah, I know they're a very fine trio of bowlers, but they've been brought up on flat pitches with the Kookaburra ball. They come in relentlessly, really hard, for over after over, ball after ball, banging it in just short of a length. You know, the odd bouncer, the glares, as you said, with Neil Wagner, that they just have this attitude that the batsmen are not going to escape from their relentless pursuit of wickets. They hunt batsmen down. And they hunted the Pakistanis down for 240 on the first day on a very good pitch. Even though there was a first wicket stand of 70-odd, they just absolutely didn't give up those bowlers and kept on at them, at the batsmen, hostile, heavy ball, banging against the splice. And then, of course, they piled up this massive score, 580, when they had the chance to bat themselves. They didn't give it away, although Steve Smith did, interestingly. His little innings was sort of a strange illustration of what happens when you wait too long to go into bat. He came into bat at 330 for two, and he was overstimulated, over eager to kind of make his presence felt, and got out almost immediately. But it didn't matter because Marlis Labuschagne played the Steve Smith role, 185 backing up David Warner's 150. you know, colossal score, after which the result was an inevitability. And the same is true in Mount Maunganui, really. Once New Zealand had that 600 and BJ Watling and Santner had ground out that big partnership lower down the order, it was probably only a matter of time before England lost.
Yeah, and there are times during England's second innings where you thought they were going to save the game. When Ben Stokes was batting with Joe Denley in the afternoon session, you thought, oh, England could save this. And then Stokes dragged on a wide one and you thought, that's changed it. And then it all unravelled fairly quickly after that. Even in that opening partnership with Sibley and Burns, they were completely untroubled for 20 overs. And then Sibley chased a wide one against Mitchell Santner, was caught behind, and Burns went to sort of slog sweet one and top edge one into the onside. Two ordinary shots, really. And I think both players, they know that they were ordinary shots. There were too many ordinary shots from England players in the second innings and in the first innings as well. So, yeah, I mean, there were times when you thought they were going to save it. But once New Zealand got those three wickets, I think by the close of the fourth day, it was always going to be tough for England on the final day. There was just a bit more in the pitch. It was just a bit of uneven banks. There was something for the spinner to work with. England were a bit passive. I mean, in a way, you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. I mean, their scoring rate was slow. They just focused on defence. I mean, the other side of it is if you're positive and then you get out playing positive shots. Having said that, a few of them did anyway. So, I don't know. It was just such a hugely frustrating performance from England. Chris Silverwood, of course, his first test as coach. I think it's fair to say things can only get better, although Duncan Fletcher was a very successful coach for England. Of course, he started with that pasting in Johannesburg back in 1999. But I don't know, there's something unconvincing about this England side, and we've said for a while.
And is it in the field? Is it in the field that's a worry? Because Root, you know, under pressure, obviously, as captain, I think he's only averaged 30 in the last year with the bat. And he does seem, I have the highest admiration for him, but there's a vacuum of ideas there, is there? It almost like it suggests that they need a leader of the attack somewhere, don't they? Which obviously Anderson has been superb at, especially in English conditions. There's something lacking in the bowling and in the whole kind of ethos when they're playing on a flat pitch away from home, which the Pat Cummingses and the Josh Hazlewoods and the Neil Wagners and Trent Bolts are such forceful characters and have such great records, but they're, as I say, they're sort of at the batsman all the time. They didn't feel as if there was that same essence when England were in the field.
Well, there certainly wasn't when the Watling and the Santner partnership got together. I mean, they tried things. They did try things, but perhaps they tried the unorthodox a bit too quickly. You know, they went to banging the ball in short when Santner came in. Perhaps they should have just bowled the length, bowled that off-stump length. I mean, I think they felt it wasn't a nick-off pitch, and they went to the short ball. They opened with Sam Curran on the fourth morning after Henry Nicholls had been hit on the head by Archer the previous evening. I didn't understand that. You'd think, OK, get Archer against Nicholls first thing in the morning. But they also gave Sam Curran the new ball as well, the second new ball. And you think, well, OK, I can sort of see what that's about. They feel that Curran might better swing the ball back in and get onto the batsman's pads and have him LBW, and then can always bring on Archer if Curran doesn't work after three or four overs. So, you know, they did try things, but you look at it individually. They've got the pace of Archer, the experience of Broad, the different angle of Sam Curran, the forcefulness of Ben Stokes, the left-arm spin of Jack Leach. But, you know, the attack just did not add up. You know, the sum of its parts, it seems quite convincing, but the whole is just entirely lacking. There was nothing there at all. And they Stuart Broad, I spoke to him this morning, did an interview with him for the BBC, and he said, well, you know, it's just such a flat pitch, you know, we should have made more runs in the first innings. Now, if he'd done so, it would have been absolutely fine. But even so, you just feel that, you know, at one point New Zealand were 316 for six, and they got 600. You know, you feel they should have been good enough to limit them. Of course, you know, and there was that moment when Ben Stokes dropped Watling on 31, and you could argue that was the most important moment in the match. He was on 31. He went on to get a double hundred. It was a straightforward catch, a slip catch, his go. It went down. So, you know, that was a really big moment. You know, it's funny, you talk about trends in a game, but actually sometimes just think about a moment, and that was probably the biggest moment in the match.
I mean, just going back to the Australian attack, the thing that marks them out for me is their fitness. You know, Pat Cummins, he just comes in, ball after ball, charging to the wicket in 28 degrees, 32 degrees. And, you know, Neil Wagner's exactly the same. And I think that that's something that we have to keep on stressing to young bowlers coming into the England side. You have to be super fit. It's a tough game. Bowling is incredibly physically hard, but you have to do those hard yards to make an impact. And I just feel that at the moment there is no bowler in that side who can really bust a gut ball after ball and ask those consistent questions of a batsman. It's probably a mindset thing as much as it is a skills thing. Of course, the other slight miserable note on England's card was this allegation of racial abuse for Jofra Archer.
Yes, Jofra Archer tweeting that he was the subject of a racist insult. It subsequently came to light that this happened as he was walking off the field after being dismissed on his way back to the pavilion. The ECB have released an official statement saying that through the scrutiny of CCTV footage at the Bay Oval, the authorities there are trying to identify the individual or individuals responsible for the remarks, and the investigation is ongoing. The statement continues, whilst this is a relatively isolated incident, there's absolutely no place for antisocial or racist behaviour within the game. It's vitally important that all spectators feel able to come forward to report such behaviour and feel safe in doing so. Such a shame, because the Bay Oval had staged such a successful and memorable test match.
Any positives out of the game from England's point of view? Sibley looked okay, though he played a poor shot in the second innings. Joe Denley, you say, you know, played pretty well. Joe Root's obviously had a poor match. But what else? Any other good signs?
Just racking my brains, Yoz. It's really hard to think of a positive thing. I think, Denley, I think, shaped well in this game, definitely. I think, you know, he got a really, really brute of a ball from Wagner today. And in the first innings, he batted well. Of course, Ben Stokes made 91. But in a way, I mean, Stokes actually, you know, he really knuckled down in both first and second innings. He looked good. And then, he might say, disappointing shots. Ben Stokes, you know, he likes to play in an expansive way once he gets going. On another day, perhaps in the first innings, on another day, he might have got a really big score. He looked as if he was set for a big score. But in a way, you know, he's 91, when he sort of charged down the pitch and tried to whack it and got caught at slip, it started England's decline. They were on course for a big score. We were thinking 450, but, you know, you can't criticise Ben Stokes. He is, well, you can, but you in one sense. But what I'm saying is, overall, you know, he's had a fantastic year. He's the heartbeat of the team. But yeah, he had, you know, there was good and bad. I mean, he played really well for his 91, dropped an absolute sitter at slip, toughed it out today for a while, and was looking good. And as I was saying earlier, you know, when he was there with Denley, it looked as if England could save the game. It gone flat, New Zealand looked a bit flat, and then he chased a wide one and dragged it onto the stumps. And after that happened, England, you know, subsided. Although, you know, Archer and Curran actually batted well in a good, sensible partnership, but they were just left with too much to do. There were very few positives for England this week, and they've got, you know, big problems overseas. You know, we've talked about the, you know, they're going to be ups and downs. They've actually tried to adjust. They've tried to solve some of their structural problems that we talked about. You talked about in the past. You know, they've had two or three wicketkeepers in the team. Well, they've just got the one now. You know, they've tried to sort out the opening partnership. They put Joe Root to number four. They brought in Pope at number six. They've got some balance to the attack. But, you know, perhaps they just haven't quite got the quality of player. They've got some exceptionally good players, of course. But overall, have they got a strong enough team? Well, not for overseas conditions. You know, even with Jofra Archer in the side, he was neutralised, about 40 overs in the second innings. Joe Root used him in short spells to start with and longer spells. I know it's only one game. The first game of an intensive winter programme, but there is a huge amount of room for improvement.
Well, what it means over the weekend is that India have taken a massive lead in the World Test Championship. They have 360 points from their seven matches. Australia just behind, and I say just, 116. They're in second place, 116 points. So 244 points behind India with a game in hand. England and New Zealand, of course, this series doesn't count in the World Test Championship, but England at the moment are in fifth spot with only 56 points. So a yawning gap opened by India. And in that match against Bangladesh, Virat Kohli made his 70th international 100. He is closing in fast on Sachin Tendulkar's 100 international 100s. I wonder if he's going to become the greatest batsman that ever lived. I mean, he's got that hunger. His average in Test cricket is 54, and in one-day cricket, ODI cricket, his average is 60. And he just shows no signs of letting up. It's incredible.
Yeah, phenomenal. Phenomenal batsman. It's hard to compare eras, isn't it? Don Bradman, obviously, is the benchmark with that average of 99. How do you compare one era with another? It's one of the it's great fun to try to do so. Who's the best batsman of all time? Sachin Tendulkar, 100 international hundreds. I mean, he's probably the modern benchmark. Kohli's just a fabulous player in all three formats of the game. I'm just while we're on India, at one point you talk about the Australian bowlers being able to bowl on flat pitches, England's bowlers struggling overseas with the Kookaburra ball. You know, India's pace bowlers, they can find some assistance. They can get something out of pitches as well. And England going to India next winter, you think about, or going to India, England have a trial by spin, but it's not just going to be trial by spin. It's also going to be trial by pace as well. They've got lots of bases covered. They are a fine all-round side, and they are odds on to play in the first World Championship final. Who will be up against them? Well, it looks like Australia, England struggling to make it. So, this is really an era of Indian dominance in Test match cricket. Of course, having said that, they don't always travel that well either, because last summer in England they were beaten 4-1, and all people say, well, the games were quite close. Well, they were, but they still lost four of them. That's the bottom line. Not easy playing away from home.
Yeah, that's true. But you mentioned one word there, pace. And if you think about their bowlers, the attack, for instance, that played against Bangladesh, Ishant Sharma, not rapid, but a clever bowler who keeps sort of adding new tricks, and he's tall. And then Umesh Yadav and Mohammad Shami, both of them are similar to Cummins and Stark. They run in hard, bowl as fast as they can. I mean, Mohammad Shami was very unlucky in that series against England, and I still have this sort of image of him, the sort of cheeks quivering as he charged to the wicket over after over, whistled one past Alistair Cook's bat, but just didn't get the rewards. So you do need extra pace to take wickets with the Kookaburra ball or the SG ball in India, and ideally a couple of good spinners as well. So well done to India. Somehow teams have got to figure out a way of beating them at home. That's the objective for all countries, I suppose. OK, so that's our look back at the Test matches over the weekend. And looking ahead, of course, England play their second Test against New Zealand in Hamilton. And at the same time, Australia host Pakistan in a day-night match at the Adelaide Oval. And talking of Australia, they are about to receive a special present. The Ashes urn is making a temporary visit. And after the break, I'll tell you why. Right, I'm in the workroom at the back of the MCC Museum, just next to the trophy cabinet where all the famous Test match trophies are housed, including, of course, the Ashes. And I'm with Neil Robinson, curator of the heritages and collections at the MCC. You were, of course, in charge of the library, but you've sort of been promoted in a way. And we've got the Ashes urn here and also the bag that it sits in, because you're transporting it to Australia.
That's right. The urn is going off to Australia for an exhibition called Velvet, Iron, Ashes, celebrating the history of the state of Victoria at the State Library of Victoria from the end of this month until the end of February 2020. So we have the urn and the velvet bag to transport out there as securely as we can. So we're having a few practice runs of how to pack it up and make sure that the transportation is carried out with the minimum risk possible.
How many times has it been abroad? Out of its cabinet?
Since it was originally presented in Australia in the 1880s, it's returned there on two occasions before. Firstly, in 1988, to celebrate the bicentennial of the country, when it stayed in a bank in Sydney and wasn't really viewed by a lot of people. More recently, and more extravagantly, we had an exhibition tour around six state capitals in 2006-2007, which was attended by over 100,000 people over a 13-week period, which was really the first opportunity we had to tell the history of the urn to a purely Australian audience in their country, and was a tremendous success for us. So this will be the third time the urn has returned to its home country.
And there is quite a sort of intricate procedure, not just the packing it up, which we'll do in a minute, but also the transportation. It's going into quite a big box. Looks like one of those photographer's boxes with all their cameras in it. And that box, I guess, is going to what? Sit next to you on the plane, is it?
That's right. It will have its own seat in business class right next to me.
Not much conversation then.
No. But at the same time, less snoring than might be anticipated from another neighbour on a long-distance flight. So an advantage from that point of view.
Let's talk about the urn a little bit before you pack it up.
Yep.
Tell us about the history, because it came to the MCC possession in the 1920s, didn't it?
That's right.
When Ivo Bligh, former captain, died, and it was presented by his wife. But how did it come by the Blythe family in the first place?
The story goes back to 1882, when England first lost at home to an Australian team. It happened at the Oval. It was a very, very dramatic match. England only needed 85 runs to win. Everyone thought they'd get it. They had W.G. Grace in their side. They had C.T. Studd in their side. He was the coming man, really, of English cricket at the time. Nobody thought they were going to lose this match. But Fred the Demon Spofforth bowled them out. They fell, I think, seven runs short. It was such a dramatic finish that one man reputedly bit through the handle of his umbrella. Another died of a brain hemorrhage, which is well attested in newspaper reports at the time. So the stress and drama must have been quite incredible on that day. And the reaction afterwards was mixed, in a way. It was ecstatic for the Australians. They were cheered all the way back to their hotel in the West End. But in the press, the England team got a rather less happy reception. And notably, a few days afterwards, a spoof obituary was placed in the Sporting Times by a journalist called Reginald Shirley Brooks, declaring the death of English cricket and the fact that the body would be cremated and the ashes taken to Australia. So that's the first time you get the idea of the ashes coming into a cricketing context. And Brooks was also involved in the campaign to legalise cremation in the country at the time, which was still illegal. So it was a way of his capitalising on the drama of the cricketing occasion to advance his political cause. But the joke caught on, and Ivo Bligh, who was leading an England team out to Australia that very winter, said that his team would go out to regain the ashes of English cricket, meaning the honour of English cricket. There were no physical ashes at the time. Billy Murdoch, the Australian captain, said that his team would defend the ashes on behalf of Australia. So the stage was set for a terrific contest for the first Ashes series. But even before the Test series took place, Ivo Bligh and the amateurs from his team were invited to stay at the Rupert's Wood home of Sir William and Lady Janet Clark, Sir William being the president of the Melbourne Cricket Club, the equivalent to MCC in Australia. And on Christmas Eve, they played a scratch match against some estate workers and other guests staying at Rupert's Wood at the time, which, of course, they won. And Lady Janet, being a bit of a humorist, thought that Ivo deserved a reward for his team's efforts on that occasion and decided that he should be rewarded with the ashes of English cricket, the honour of English cricket that his team had regained. So we took what She took what we think was probably a little perfume bottle or an ointment jar that she'd picked up on a trip to Europe, perhaps in a classical site like Italy or Greece. A bale was burnt from one of the wickets that was used in the match, and the ashes from that were placed in the urn, and it was presented to Ivo as the ashes of English cricket. And this, of course, was even before the Test series had begun. So it's curious to imagine why Ivo would have kept that memento were it not for the fact that it was a deeply personal time for him, because not only was he out there to win a cricket series, he was also out there as it turned out, to woo the lady of his future dreams. He met at Rupert's Woodhouse a lady called Florence Rose Morphy, who was a companion to Lady Janet, governess and piano teacher to the Clark children, and they fell in love. And subsequently, they married. Ivo became Lord Darnley, she became Lady Darnley, and the urn remained with them as a treasured personal memento because it reminded them of the time they'd met and
I suppose it was a sort of a symbol of their meeting and their marriage in a way.
Absolutely. And that's why it became such a treasured family possession for them. And really, when you look at all the controversy there's been over the urn and the fact that there was such a demand when the Australians were having such a big run of winning series in the 90s and early 2000s, that the urn should travel and be recognised as a trophy. At its heart, it's a love story between an English guy and an Australian girl, so it should be something that brings us together rather than ever dividing us in any way. And I think it should be remembered that it was a very personal thing for Ivo and not really associated with the Test series at all.
And it was in the Bligh family, in their home until Ivo died, right? And then it came by the MCC?
Yes, Ivo died in 1927, and the urn was presented to us by his widow in 1928. And really, until that point, nobody knew of its existence outside the family. The ashes idea itself had disappeared for 20 years after the conclusion of that Test series in Australia, which England won 2-1, by the way, although another match was played subsequently, which the Australians won, so you might argue it was a 2-2 draw. But at the end of that tour, at the farewell dinner given to Ivo's team by the Melbourne Cricket Club, Ivo spoke and declared that the ashes should be buried in a corner of the Melbourne Cricket Ground and forgotten. He didn't mean this little urn, because he took that back home with him. He meant the idea of the ashes. And it was indeed forgotten for 20 years until Pelham Warner reignited it after his 1903-04 victorious tour of Australia by writing a book called How We Recovered the Ashes. So the idea of the ashes reignited from that point. But the urn didn't really come back in until it was put on public display at the end of the 1920s here at Lord's. And it's only really by an association of ideas that has grown over the decades since then that the urn has become the symbol of the Test series. And if you look back through the literature, a lot of the cartoons, a lot of the match programmes that featured illustrations, the representations of the urn right up to the 1980s weren't necessarily identical with the urn we have here at Lord's today. There were many, many different ways of depicting the idea of the ashes from trash cans to rather more ornamental Victorian type urns. So it really is curious that it's become so closely associated with the idea of this Test series when for many decades it was really nowhere in the picture.
Looking at it, people are often surprised by how small it is to start with. It's only 6 inches tall, isn't it?
Yep.
And it weighs, barely anything. What about the inside? Now, you say it's a bale. Other people have said in the past that it's a burnt veil.
Mm.
You've looked inside it.
We've x-rayed it as part of the condition reporting process initially before it went off on the 06-07 tour. And we could see from that x-ray that there was a deposit of some kind in the bottom. I suppose we could take the cork out and have it analysed, but all that would really tell us was whether it was organic-based or something else. It wouldn't really tell us exactly what was in there or whether it was the ashes of a wooden bale or perhaps ashes from the fire grate. There is a story that while at Cobham Hall, the home of the Darnleys, it was knocked off the mantelpiece by a careless maid who dusted the ashes back inside in a bit of a hurry. But that may well have some truth in it. So we don't really know what's inside for sure, and there are various stories. When we tell the story of the ashes urn, it's our understanding of what the likeliest scenario is. And as for proving what's in there or otherwise, well, it adds to the mystique that we don't really know.
So you've never been tempted to try and take the cork out?
Absolutely not. To be honest, Simon, I handle the item as rarely as possible, and it's something that we really revere for its mystique as much as anything else.
And you said that you thought it might have been purchased originally in Italy, sort of in what, the 1880s, as a memento of a trip abroad by these Australians.
That's right. We know that Sir William and Lady Janet made several visits to Europe. In fact, when Ivo and his team travelled out to Australia on the SS Peshawar, Sir William and Lady Janet were actually on the same boat. They were returning from a trip to Europe at the time. So it is tempting to think, if you look at the shape of the urn, small as it is, it does have a sort of classical Roman or Greek appearance of what might have been a larger original urn. So it's tempting to think it might well have been picked up at a souvenir stall at Pompeii or some other classical site in the ancient world. We'll never really know for sure, because it's 150 years ago now. But it's as likely an explanation for its origin as any. Put it in. Never hold it by the stem of the vessel here. That's much too fragile.
So it's placed in its position, and you put your
Yes, then we've got additional three layers of foam to go over the top to protect it from any damage to the case. There we go. Three layers securely in. Close the case. Just clip shut like that. And there we go. We are fully packed up and ready to travel.
And what's planned in Melbourne?
Well, we open to the public on Tuesday the 26th of November. So there is a big launch event featuring various dignitaries. I believe we're going to have a live video cast from Tim Payne, the Australian captain, who recently held a replica of the urn up at the Oval himself. So knows pretty much what he's talking about and certainly knows what the idea of the Ashes means to Australian cricketers. So, yeah, it'll be a huge, huge opening event, and I hope it encourages as many people as possible to come along and see the exhibition.
And where will it be, the exhibition?
The exhibition's held in the State Library of Victoria, which is in central Melbourne, and it's running for 3 months, or at least the Ashes display part of it is running for 3 months.
So there you go. If you're in the Melbourne area, that's quite an interesting little visit to go down to the State Library and check out the Ashes. I suppose it's appropriate that it's back at its origins in a way where it originally came from. And apologies to anybody who visits the MCC Museum over the next few weeks and finds no Ashes urn in the cabinet, but there's plenty of other stuff to look at, so I guess it'll be back soon. Just one other thing, the new Cricketer magazine is out this week, a big issue all about the world of cricket and how it's expanding into corners of the globe that it hasn't really penetrated into before. Very interesting issue, and there is a special offer on the Cricketer this month. If you buy a subscription for a year, which is around about, you get in return a £20 John Lewis gift voucher or a copy of Alistair Cook's autobiography. So it's a pretty good deal. You go to www.thecricketer.com/Christmas and that offer is there for you. Thanks very much for listening, and we'll be back to talk about England's exploits in New Zealand on Friday.
Podcast Network. Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.